and we are live. Hey, this is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and I'm here at the store, and with the miracle of technology, we're in four different locations today. I've got PJ Tracy tuning in from, are you in Los Angeles,
Tracy? I'm in Minneapolis.
Oh, Minneapolis, okay. Discussing her brand new book, Deep Into the Dark, and then we have Joanna Schaffhausen, discussing her new book, which I don't have a copy of in front of me yet, but we are going to have signed copies shortly. Let's see here. We do have copies, signed copies, Tracy's new book right here. And then Barbara's tuning in from home, and I'm going to let her take over here. But if you're watching on Facebook and you have questions for our authors, I'll be monitoring the Facebook feed. But then luckily, I will be largely invisible. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you very much. Patrick will tune back in after a while if he has questions or comments, and he always has questions of his own too, which is really fun. So this is really wonderful to see Tracy again. We have a wonderful, beautiful photograph of Tracy and her late mother that in the bookstore that I often see because it's fairly close to where I sit when we're hosting. So we had several lovely monkey wrench conversations with Tracy and her mom. But I'm really pleased to see that tonight we are talking about a new start, a new series for Tracy. I have not met Joanna before, nor, and this is embarrassing, have I actually read her first three books. And I want to talk about them somewhat tonight because I think that to read her fourth book, which is what we're here to discuss, there are relationship spoilers that if you haven't read the first three, they will not have the same impact on you as if you go back and read them after you've read this book, as if you started there. So fortunately, it's only three other books, so not an insurmountable obstacle, right? So Joanna, since I brought all that up, talk to us a bit about your series and the genesis of it, because you have a really interesting main character.
Okay, thanks, Barbara. And yes, so my series is the Ellery Hathaway series, and it has two main characters, one of whom is Ellery Hathaway, and the other is Reed Markham. And they are loosely based on two real people, or inspired, I should say, based is probably stretching it, two real people from the Ted Bundy case, the notorious serial killer. Reed, the FBI agent, is inspired by a man named Bob Keppel, who was working Seattle homicide for 1 week when he caught the Ted Bundy case. Imagine being on the job 1 week and that's like your first case, you know, is like Ted Bundy. Talk about jumping into the deep end. Anyway, he didn't set out to specialize in serial murder, but he ended up doing that. He went on to pursue the Green River Killer, Gary Ridgway. When Bundy was eventually caught, Keppel was one of the people who flew to Florida to try to get him to confess to other crimes. Like, he ended up, like, it changed the complete trajectory of his career. Bundy happened to him. Mm-hmm. And Ellery is inspired by Carol DeRanche, who was 18 and shopping at a Utah mall when Ted Bundy, posing as a cop, abducted her. And she managed to escape and became the beginning of Ted Bundy's end, because now there was a living witness. This was decades ago now, like 40 years ago. Bundy's been dead for 20 years. She still gets 15 messages a day about Bundy.
Wow.
There's a new book every year, a new TV series, a movie or whatever. And every time, because Carol is such a pivotal figure in the Ted Bundy story, that she gets hauled out and paraded in front of the cameras, interviews, pressure, people always wanting to know, what was he like? What was it like? Pretending to be other victims so they can talk to her. Some guy pretended to be her son a few years ago, and she had to come out and say, no, I don't have a son. But the point is, she escaped. It was this one moment, maybe the whole thing lasted half an hour, and he completely took over her life. He's been dead, but he still follows her around like a ghost.
So she's a person of unwanted celebrity, forced to deal with it. And of course, today in an age of social media, where she, you know, it's even more of a problem. You know, this is so interesting because we were lucky enough to have Ann Rule come to visit us two or three times. And she always talked about, you know, her own experience with Ted Bundy, because her her fabulous career in true crime was inspired, in fact, by the Bundy case. You know, she worked alongside him, and
you couldn't make that story up.
No, you absolutely could not. And isn't it frightening to think that somebody like that has no, unless, you know, can look like a normal functioning human being, and yet, you know, behind the mask, there is this amazing stuff going on.
I think that's one reason we keep telling the story over and over again. It's so shocking. It remains shocking every year. But when I was reading one of the Bundy books, I was struck a number of years ago by the people outside the story who got sucked in, and what it must be like that public appetite for this story remains so high that they never escape it, and it ends up kind of defining them. So that's kind of what the books are about, is living in the aftermath of this infamous case and trying to carve out an identity for yourself separate from what that happened.
So Ellery and Reed this is their fourth book together, and their relationship has evolved. We won't say how, but she keeps getting hauled in when a similar case comes along. The two of them somehow or other get sucked back into a similar situation.
Yeah, I think what binds them together is that they're the two people who know the truth of the story. You know, the media runs with it, and everybody is always eager for more, but these are the two people that lived it, and it binds them together in a way that no other two people on earth are. And that's part of the attraction for one another. So for Reed, it became this great case that catapulted him to fame, and he became a hotshot FBI profiler, and he wrote a best-selling book about it. And for Ellery, it's this living nightmare that she can't escape from. So bringing those two perspectives back together and forcing them to interact. I mean, I always say that Reed has always told himself that he's the big hero, that he saved her. And in reuniting, he gets to find out whether that's really true.
Wow. Well, let's come back to Every Waking Hour in a minute, but let's zip up here to Tracy. Tracy, are you missing the Monkey Wrench gang? I mean, they were a part of your life for so long.
Oh, they really were. And they still are. They will never cease to be part of my life, especially since, you know, it was PJ's and my baby from inception and throughout 10 books. So I do miss them in a way, but in another way, you know, it was definitely time to turn a corner. After she passed, I wrote two Monkey Wrench novels solo, and it was absolutely essential for me to do that. It was my catharsis, and it was solace, and it kept me right here so close. You know, basically it was my grief counseling. And then when I was finishing Ice Cold Heart, the writing began to feel really, really lonely. And that's when I knew that it was time to re-energize and, you know, kind of enter an entirely new fictional world and start a new venture.
Sure. Do you think that, you know, technology has moved so fast? Was it harder for you writing the Monkey Wrench? You know, at the beginning, you were really cutting edge, but was it hard to, you know, keep up and keep in front of it?
Well, actually it wasn't, because I have so many great resources who are, you know, computer gods and goddesses like the Monkey Wrench gang were. So I'd love to do research. And that was a huge part of preparation for each book, is like talking to hackers and talking to software architects and people that truly were on the cutting edge. And they were very, you know, kind to give me their time. And the other thing about technology is that you can write about it in the year it takes for a manuscript to become a book. Whatever crazy thing you can make up, it's real. Because I always remember asking my father, it's like, is this possible? And he's like, no, but check with me in 2 weeks. It probably will be, you know.
That's so funny. You know, I've told this story before to some of our listeners, but when I was a child, my grandparents lived across the street from Chester Gould, the Dick Tracy guy.
Oh, really?
And I remember, because, you know, I mean, we're talking now in the 1940s, I remember how excited we all were at the thought of the two-way wristwatch. You know, it seemed like an inconceivably advanced, you know, communication technology. And of course now, you know, we're all carrying around phones and we can call home from Mount Everest and, you know, all the rest of it. But I remember, you know, thinking over the years how, you know, whatever Gould envisioned has come true. And you're right that stuff we think can't possibly happen, all of a sudden, it's right in front of us.
Yes, you can come up with the most outrageous scenario and eventually it will happen.
Very true. In fact, Joanna, we could certainly say that the FBI has tools for tracking people and, you know, identifying that were absolutely not available during the Ted Bundy case. You know, mm-hmm. national crime databases, DNA evidence, you know, all kinds of stuff, which means that people writing serial killer novels have to up their game.
Absolutely.
So anyway, back to Tracy. You've got three, if I remember right, three kind of lead characters in this new book. So
yes.
One of them is damaged. He's suffering from PTSD. So why don't you introduce your three characters to us?
Sam Easton is a combat veteran and he is just back home from to Los Angeles after almost being killed in a roadside bombing. And you know, he is badly damaged physically and emotionally, and he is trying to pull his life back together. And it's with mixed results because there are often times when he can't distinguish reality from some warped fantasy that's born of PTSD. So he's certainly struggling. And when his wife leaves him, he becomes close to Melly Traeger, who is a coworker and also a woman battling her own demons and hiding her own secrets. And when her abusive boyfriend is murdered, Sam becomes the prime suspect. Poor Sam, poor Sam. And then enters Detective Margaret Nolan, who is very smart, very savvy, you know, quite tough, but she is also conflicted because her brother has also recently been killed in Afghanistan. And this is all set against the backdrop of a Los Angeles being terrorized by a serial killer called the Monster of Miracle Mile. And you know, you would be right in assuming that several storylines begin to entwine as the book unfolds.
Absolutely. So I'm going to now reveal how far out of the mainstream I have fallen and ask you, what is a barback? I mean, this is Sam's job, and I'm going, what the hell is that?
A barback is just the guy who schleps booze from the back room when the bartender needs it.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, he's not actually mixing drinks or whatever. He's like the muscle.
He's the muscle. He is, you know, he's manual labor. And, you know, he is trained as an engineer. He has an engineering degree, but, you know, he needs a simple life when he's trying to recover and restore his sanity. And so barback was it.
So why did you select Los Angeles as the landscape for this book? I mean, you're in Minnesota, the Monkey Ranch books were Middle West to the great degree.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I lived in Los Angeles for 10 years and I had this vast repository of observations and experiences. And when I finished the 10th Monkey Ranch, they were just all clamoring to get out. They're like, let me out, let me out. And so I did. I mean, it could not be ignored. And, you know, it was so much fun to go back to Los Angeles because, I mean, you can't think of two more polar opposites than Minneapolis and Los Angeles. You know, the Midwest is fabulous to write about. It's got tons of regional personality and cultural curiosities and really endless things to write about. But I mean, LA, my goodness, you know, I mean, it's so over the top. And I always think of LA as like sort of the wild and crazy alter ego of Minneapolis, just ready to party. So it was fun to do that. And plus when you have that, when you experience something, you've lived there and you're part of that culture as well. It's really interesting, you know, to come back, reflect on that. You know, the mirror of exile can be very intense. So, you know, I just sort of marinated things for a while when I moved back to Minnesota and out it came.
Wonderful. Now, Joanna, you say you live near Boston, but in your books, you have moved your characters around, right?
Yeah, a little bit. The first book is in Western Massachusetts, which is smaller and more rural. And the second book is in Boston. The third book is actually in Las Vegas because Reed and Ellery go to Las Vegas to try to solve his mother's murder because his mother was murdered there when he was a baby. It's a very cold case. at that point. So they go back and try and unearth some secrets. That's All the Best Lies, which is the third one, just out in paperback. And then the most recent one, Every Waking Hour, is back in Boston, where Ellery is now a detective.
I'm going to be talking to Lisa Gardner tomorrow night, which is a very Boston case. So, you know, it's always interesting to me how some cities attract a disproportionate number of crime writers compared. I mean, I'm from Chicago. I'm from Winnetka, actually, north of Chicago. But, you know, they're not for the size of Chicago. There are not a huge number of crime writers living and writing about Chicago. But Boston's always had loads. Minnesota, Minneapolis, the Twin Cities have a remarkable number. Los Angeles is like, you know, overrun. Yeah. And Phoenix, where I, you know, Scottsdale, where I live now, has very few again. So I often wonder, you know, what's the cluster effect, you know, when you get, you know, who knows?
It's anyway. Like a disease, who knows? Well, I can say for sure that in Minnesota, we have very long winters. So what else are you gonna do?
Right, time to sit home and brood about ways to kill people. Right. So in Every Waking Hour, you have a really fascinating backstory. I wish we could talk about the entire thing, but the reason that they are at work is that a child is disappeared, right? Mm-hmm. Young yep. Chloe Lockhart, age 12.
Yeah, she disappeared from the fair, yeah.
Right, so her mother is a fairly high powered, is she a surgeon, if I remember right?
Yep, she's a surgeon.
And she is a stepfather. Her other father, I'm trying to remember, he's in the book, but she's living with her stepfather and her mother, right?
So it's those are her biological parents. So those are her parents, but the mom was previously married. So there's the dad.
Oh, that's it. I'm sorry, I had it wrong. Right. These are her biological parents, but there's an ex from her mother.
Yeah.
In the background. And is there a child from her first marriage or not?
Well, there was, but he was murdered around the same age as Chloe. So when she disappears, Teresa, her mom's first reaction is, oh my God, this can't be happening again. And so one of the main things that Reed and Ellery have to figure out is, did Chloe run away because her parents were very suffocating in their surveillance of her because of what happened to the first child? And so was she just trying to get out from under them, or was she in fact abducted? And if so, is it related to this unsolved murder of her brother from years ago?
So her mom being a busy surgeon and gone so much, Chloe has a nanny, right?
Yep.
And the nanny unfortunately took her eye off, or allowed her to go off, if I remember right, to buy, I don't remember, ice cream or pretzels or something or other. When she disappeared, her half brother, the deceased one, also had a nanny. So there are a lot of parallels in what's happening to Chloe that happened previously. So the alert reader, of course, is wondering whether there are any connections or whether this is just, you know, a hideous twist of fate revisiting this mother. But meantime, we don't really know what's going on with Chloe. I mean, we're not finding her body. We're trying to chase her, which I think adds a lot of interest. So is Reed, why is Reed there? Is he charged with finding this missing girl?
Well, he's on vacation and visiting with his young daughter when Chloe goes missing. But Reed, as part of his background as a profiler, lends his skills to the case since he's on hand, but Ellery is in charge as the detective. But of course, Ellery, they met when Ellery was 14 and abducted by the serial killer, and then rescued by Reed, who is very green. He's the guy who just was new on the job when he inherited the big serial killer case, and he played a hunch and he rescued Ellery all those years ago, and now she's grown up. And you know, she's 30 and on the job and self-sufficient and everything. And so they have a relationship as adults and equals now.
And well, he's still in the FBI, but she is actually on a tryout with the police department, right? So she's decided on a career in law enforcement.
Yes, she's working as a small town cop in the first book. But after things blow up there, she moves to Boston and is looking for a fresh start. But because of her volatile history, it's kind of like a probationary period at the beginning. So she's trying to keep her nose clean amid this case with the abduction of a young girl, which kind of brings up obvious memories for her.
Well, we can't really say anything more about the book without developing spoilers and so forth, but I found it a fascinating story with a real surprise. So bravo. And I really want to go back and read the first three to get to this point. What would you advise readers? Would you advise them the same thing?
Well, of course, obviously you ought to be like, yes, read them all, readers. I think, you know, like you said earlier, Barbara, the relationships and the character arc, you definitely, it's hard to leap in the middle of that because the characters grow and change over the course of the four books. The mysteries are self-contained. They don't, like, you can read one and you won't be lost. It's not like you read two and you're spoiled for one or whatever. So they stand alone, but the character development, it's best to read it in order. And the first one is called The Vanishing Season.
That's always, I think, an interesting question with a series, you know. Certainly as a bookseller, we have people always asking us, you know, can I start here? And the truth is, in some series, you can say, yeah, you know, you can start wherever you are and it won't hurt anything. But in other series, and this is why it's important that we actually have read the earlier books so we know what we're talking about, sometimes you really do want to go back and say, no, start at the very beginning. The cases will all be distinct, but the character things, well, I always think of Elizabeth Peters and the Crocodile on the Sandbank, because if you didn't read it first in the Amelia Peabody series, you would never be able to read the Crocodile on the Sandbank after reading any other book without realizing that the main suspect was clearly innocent all the way through the book. I mean, it just ruins it. So.
It's tough.
So Tracy, you're listening to all that. This is book one of a series, and you know, you've already written a long-term series with lots of relationships in it. What do you anticipate? Well, are you going on with this cast of characters?
I am. I actually 2 weeks ago just finished the sequel, so yay. Very exciting. Yeah, we're always excited to finish a book. So yeah, it's just, you know, there's so many places to go, and the sophomore effort is always the most difficult, but in ways it's the most rewarding when you're starting out. I mean, this was actually written as a standalone, as was Monkey Wrench, but they asked for it to become a series. And, you know, the first book, you're just getting acquainted with them and you're ruining their lives and then restoring their sanity and doing all kinds of things. But then the second book is when you really, really, really start to get into their psyche and the synergy between them and the other characters and, you know, the setting and the new plot. So series writing, I really totally agree that there are definitely series that you can read as standalones, as you both mentioned. The mystery itself, well, the case itself is a standalone, but I think the most important part about a really compelling story is the characters. I mean, they're the foundation and they lead you through everything. And you know, if you care about the characters, and as a, you know, you're hoping your readers do, it's always best, I think, to start at the beginning, because it's wild if you go from, like, you know, and Joanna, you know this, I mean, from the first book to the fourth, wow, you know, I mean, how much has changed. So it's fun. I do love to write series though, because you're not just, you know, shoving aside these great people you've spent a lot of time getting to know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you look back at an earlier age, if you look back at Travis McGee, you look back at Poirot or Miss Marple, they were not seriously affected in a subsequent book by the things that happened to them in an earlier book. But we are asking more of that now, I think, when we are reading series. We're asking for characters who are changed by the events. You know, they're wounded physically, they're wounded psychically, their lives blow up, they have whatever. And so, you know, you can read Poirot in any order. It doesn't really matter. But you can't, you could read Russ McDonald, you could read Lou Archer in any order, because he was always, in fact, McDonald said of him that, you know, he was like a shadow. If you turned him sideways, you could barely even see him in the books, because he was, he wasn't, it was a different way of presenting a case.
Yeah.
But I don't think that we can do that now. And I wonder, do you think that's more true of books written? Here's a feminist question. More true of books written by women, or do you think this applies now? This is for both of you. Do you think that series written by men have the same dynamic and the same demands from readers that series written by women do?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, men, we all know men and women are extremely different, and, you know, their brains are wired differently. And I think the way they approach writing is, I mean, there are certain series where there's definitely an arc and there's a development. But I think maybe just the way we are as women, that's, you know, the relationships kind of are, you know, fundamental and to us. And as a writer writing crime, I feel that it is so important that, yes, you have violence, you have crime, you have to have the plot. But it's just, to me, I'm not writing about a crime or crimes. I'm writing about how the violence affects the cops and the victims and the people around it, that there's this huge ripple effect, and a single crime, single murder affects hundreds of people, literally. And that's always in the back of my mind. And I, you know, I mean, I'm a softie, I'm very different from men. And I think that maybe there are more female writers who do spend more time on the relationships.
Joanna, do you want to chime in?
I mean, I agree with everything Tracy said. I also think, just in general, you know, our appetite collectively for how we tell stories and crime stories now. It's not, you look back like Matlock and Murder, She Wrote, and some of the, you know, the A-Team or whatever. This was the kind of stories where you could tune in every week and the characters reset no matter what happened to them. You know, you'd rejoin them the next week, and if you hadn't seen last week, it didn't matter. But now, you know, with series on television, it's the same thing, where the characters are expected to react to things that happened last week. And you can't just start in season two or whatever, and you'll be missing stuff. So I think the way audiences consume stories now is that there is more of an appetite for this deeper exploration, as Tracy was saying, about the impacts of the things that happen to the characters and how that changes them and the relationships. And so I think crime writing in literature is part of that shift.
I think, because, you know, we host, we're an interesting bookstore. Half of our customer base is male and half female. You know, we're not primarily female, and my staff are lots of guys as well as women. But I've been thinking about some of the authors that we've spent careers with, like C.J. Box. Every single book, Joe Pickett and his whole family react and change. I was thinking about Nick Petrie, whose book we talked about a couple of weeks ago. And in The Breaker, June, the woman that Peter Ash meets in the second book, and they become lovers and so forth. In this new book, The Breaker, is basically her book. I mean, it's Nick and his sidekick guy, Lewis. But really, June is the remarkable voice in the book, and it becomes her book, and they react to things. So I think that, my question was sort of loaded in the sense that I do think that we ask of all writers now, mm-hmm, for much more in the way of developing characters and relationships and reactions than we once did, which brings me back to my original question: where do you start? Right. All right. So Tracy, we haven't really talked about the plot. We've talked about the characters. So can you give us a short plot summary here without spoilers of what happens?
Oh my gosh, I feel so much pressure. It's always so hard to give the, you know, by the way. As I mentioned, Sam becomes a prime suspect in the homicide of Melody's abusive husband, or abusive boyfriend, I'm sorry. And there are more murders that occur, and I just can't say what they are, but Sam and Melody both become suspects. And at the same time, there are certain events with secondary characters that come into Sam's life and then bleed into Melody's life. that put them in great peril, but they're not aware of it. Melody also has a stalker, or she believes she has a stalker. And Sam believes it's the same stalker that's been parked outside his house. But of course, Sam doesn't know because he has blackouts and hallucinations. And at a certain point, they end up fleeing the cops because they know, or they think they know, that they're not guilty, but they need to find a way to prove it. Otherwise, they are in deep water.
So what's the role of your policewoman? I mean, you know, they're so obvious as suspects. Does she give them some rope to, or do they have to seize it themselves?
Well, her partner is a detective named Alan Crawford, and he's sort of her mentor and older, and he's kind of bringing her up through the LAPD and robbery homicide. And they have another conflict is between Margaret and Al, because he wants them both bad and she doesn't believe it. So they, you know, they're constantly butting heads against this. And, you know, as more people die and more things, you know, are pointing fingers at Melody and Al, it sort of blows up. And there's also another secondary character, Remy Boudreau, who may become a romantic interest in Margaret Nolan's life. And he's working the Monster of Miracle Mile case. And suddenly things in Seb and Melody's murder cases bleed over into the serial killer. So everybody's in trouble now. Nobody knows what's going on, including the author, as I was writing about it. So part of the resolution and the fun of writing it was actually bringing these things together. Like, I'm this insane knitter with like 40 needles all around me and all these skeins of yarn. I'm trying to figure it out. So it's just, you know, it was very organic and exciting and process to be writing like that. It was different from Monkey Wrench. And I think that Sam and Melody certainly become heroes in their own way.
Yeah, but in Monkey Wrench, you know, you balanced an awful long, I mean, you had a large and complicated cast. It wasn't just like one person, but there were what, five or six at least of the basic.
Oh yes, exactly. I mean, Monkey Wrench, you had the cops, and then there were the other cops, and there was family members and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I mean PJ and I were always beating ourselves up. It's like, why did we do this to ourselves? Because you have to give them equal billing. If you have main characters, doesn't matter if you have 40, they all need love, you know. And our feeling was always that even if you write a character that only shows up one time in one book, they need the same attention to detail because, you know, humans are complex and the characters need to be too.
You know, Dana Stabenow lives with us part of the year, escaping what used to be winter in Alaska and is now dreary rain and whatever. But she's been espousing the idea recently to me because we have a lot of literary discussions that every character deserves at least a couple of lines of backstory. You can't just throw a character in without some sort of, you know, no matter how minor they are,
right.
The reader needs to have just that, you know, and that's hard to keep track of when you have a complicated book with a lot of, you know, participants to even get to the walk-on characters, some kind of personality and some kind of anchor. And plus, you know, you never know when you're writing a series and one of those characters might suddenly leap up. I know that Nick did not envision June, you know, initially as, you know, becoming a full-fledged character in the book and then having basically her own book when he wrote her in book two, you know. So I think that that's another reason to really take care of placing these characters.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I mean, in Monkey Wrench, you know, we always were mindful of like, who's going to come back? And so we're so glad we did spend that time because characters did recur. And as a matter of fact, in the sequel to Deep Into the Dark, I brought a secondary Minneapolis character back. He was he used to be LAPD homicide and became a private detective. Mm-hmm. So it was fun. He was from LA. Now he's back in LA. So it was fun to revisit an old character from another book.
sometimes animals get into it. I was talking to Ace Atkins last week about his new Spencer novel, and we're on a new Pearl. Pearl's a puppy now because Pearl, in the course of time, you know, has died. This might be the third Pearl. I can't remember. But anyway, so we have a puppy Pearl who's taking up space in the book. And well, but you know, she's become one of the ensemble cast.
Yes.
So a trick of it, I think, is to work out, if you have a lot of characters, which ones come forward in which book, because mm-hmm. you can't bring them all. Or, right. or the whole thing becomes completely unwieldy. Joanna, what have you done about that? You've got your repeating characters. You've got Ellery and Reed, but you have some secondary characters who pop in as well.
Yep. Reed has a daughter, Tula, who's, you know, she ages over the book, but she's like 6 to 8. And Ellery has speaking of animals, a basset hound named Speed Bump, who has quite a fan club. I also have a basset hound. His name is Winston.
You and Martin Walker. Martin Walker has the most wonderful basset hound. And the first one died. And now he's on basset hound number 2.
They are fun. A lot of personality in the basset hound. So depending, there's more or less of a role for Speed Bump, depending on where the mystery is set. Like when they went to Las Vegas, he didn't come with them. But when Ellery's based in Boston in book 4, you know, the dog has a decent sized role. But yeah, I mean, part of the fun of writing the series is bringing forward some relationships. Reed has a big family. We meet them in some books, but not others. And you know, seeing how bringing forward these other secondary characters changes the relationships of the main characters too, so that's always fun.
So before Patrick pumps back in, do either of you have a question for the other? It's been all me up till this moment, but is there something you'd like to ask Tracy, or Tracy, is there something you'd like to ask Joanna?
Yeah, I do want to ask Joanna. You have such an interesting background. And and by the way, I'm super excited when I looked you up, when I learned that I was really speaking with you. And so I have The Vanishing Season on order. Okay. And I can't wait to get into it because it sounds so fascinating. Given your background, what made you want to write, and when did you know?
Oh God, since I knew what a writer was.
Okay.
Like I tell this story, I knew I was a writer in third grade. We had a weekly creative writing assignment where the teacher would give us one line and we had to tell the story where it went from that opening line. And everybody would write a paragraph in my class in third grade, and I would write pages. And they were mysteries even back then. And I would write the solution upside down at the end so the teacher could try to solve it herself if she wanted.
I love that
you could tell I really meant it because I was punishing myself, because the way the assignment worked is we wrote it on that crappy paper.
Yeah, the lined paper.
Yeah, and barely held a pencil. And yep. Then she would correct it and we had to rewrite it with correct grammar and spelling and everything. So everybody else would be out like at recess and I would be there laboriously recopying my paper. But I had to tell the stories, even though there was a cost to me. I knew I had to tell them. And so finally I'm living the dream.
You know, that's so interesting that you said that about your third grade teacher, because that's exactly how PJ and I started.
Really?
From the time I was a little kid, bedtime story hour, and we always ran out of books. And PJ had this great idea. It's like, well, let's write our own story. And she would do the same thing. She would come up with one line and then I would rip up that. And then she would do another and we go back and forth. And depending on my age, it was either like 4 lines or maybe, you know, as I got older, more advanced, like 10 lines. Mm-hmm. But we always acted them out with my stuffed animals. So that was the genesis of us writing together and of me being a writer too.
Oh, well, I am reading Deep Into the Dark now. I'm about 30% done and I'm really loving it.
Oh, thank you.
Right up my alley. And my question is, it's obviously, you could tell from your description, really a complex story with all these different characters. And like, did you map all that out beforehand? Like, where, what was the start of that story for you? Like, where did it begin?
Well,
this big thing.
You know, I can't outline. I have never outlined and I never will. My brain does not work that way. So nothing is mapped out at all. The beginning, this was Sam's book and it started with Sam. And just, I have a lot of experience, friends, family members, so forth, that have, you know, combat experience. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, researched that and just finally realized that, you know, sometimes battle after the battle is the most difficult. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to highlight that. And so that was the kernel of Sam. And just because he's struggling so much emotionally, I just kind of took that and ran with it. And literally, and this is a little bit different than the way the Monkey Wrench books went. I had no idea where it was going. I would just write and a new character would pop up and then a new element, the plot would pop up and then more characters and more plot. So it really was unplanned and very spontaneous and very dynamic. And when I finished, I'm like, I'm never going to remember how I did this. And I don't.
So did you start at the beginning or did you start somewhere in the middle?
I really did start in the beginning because I have to because the characters write the story, not me. But I did start at the beginning, but started with Sam. And then when Nolan had to inevitably show up, I went back and then, you know, wrote her from the beginning because she had to, you know, have a life and a realistic past and present and personality. So I guess, you know, it's just kind of like, it's like Barbara's beautiful quilt behind her. Yeah. You have one block and then you get another one and just like arrange it.
Yep. I'm really glad you addressed that because one of the questions we always get from the audience is about writing process. So you've preempted that. Patrick, are you lurking, ready to come back in?
I am lurking.
Okay.
Okay, I'm back.
Hey,
let's see. Not as many questions as I'd hoped for, but a few. Let's see. Maureen asks Tracy. She says, in your Goodread reviews, some reviewers have mentioned that Sam seems to take over the book and almost makes Margaret a secondary character. So will Sam be in later books or is he one and done?
Oh, no. They all come back in the sequel. And it's, Maureen has good points. This was Sam's book, most definitely. And, you know, it was kind of by design. It's the way it ended up being written. And the great thing about doing a series is that you can focus on somebody else in the next book. So the sequel that I've completed is Margaret's. So she's number one. But Sam does come back, as does Remy and, you know, Al and, you know, Melody to a certain degree. So it's just, you know, there'll be one focus. And then book number three, I have no idea. I might make somebody else up.
It's very much an ensemble cast.
Yes, always.
Did you find, it's funny because you did just describe a little bit about how you began with Sam and then went and kind of salted Margaret's story back in. Was there anything about Margaret that really surprised you while you were sort of inventing her world? I mean, there's definitely something that combat veterans and, you know, hardened police have in common. You know, I mean, their eyes have been opened in a way that most of us haven't, you know, and they've seen things that we can't, you know, that they can't unsee. So there is quite a bit of crossover there.
There really is. It, I mean, Nolan surprised me in some ways because, you know, she is, I think, you know, all cops are tormented by these horrible things they see. But it was getting into her head and actually kind of feeling with her and exploring it that this really does tear her up in a profound way. And I think, you know, that's part of her connection, empathy for Sam. They do have a shared, you know, they definitely have a shared experience and shared trauma, and as the book progresses, you know, that goes on. And it's really, I've known a lot of people who have done these jobs And just the personality and the different ways that they deal with it is so incredibly, you know, it's broad. Not everyone does the same thing. Not everyone reacts the same way. But in general, you know, it's just, if you're human, you're going to be affected by this. And, you know, in fiction, you know, it's really, it's an interesting thing to explore because you're really getting into the psyche of everybody.
Yeah, it's true. Also for Joanna, I don't know if you've seen, we just watched that new Night Stalker series that just came out, you know, and like the Bundy case, of course, it's a very high profile, notorious case. But one of the things that they went into was just about how people over, you know, the last 30 years or something, how they've been affected, you know, by these crimes. And there was one woman who was, well, she was a little girl then, she was 6 years old then, and was, you know, abducted by Ramirez and brutalized in unspeakable ways. And, you know, my wife was watching it too. And she's like, this woman is my hero because she is, you know, just so strong, and people don't react the way you expect them to. And it was very interesting to watch. And I think that's probably true with the Bundy case as well.
Yep. I mean, people react in different ways. I have a very sweet friend. She's petite and Italian and just sweet as pie. And one day she came into her kitchen to discover there was an intruder there. And she yelled at him and chased him out. He ran. And, you know, this is like a completely, you would never guess from talking to her, she's so mild-mannered, that like she's gonna face down an intruder and chase him out of her house. Like you'd say, no, this wouldn't happen in a million years, but it did. Like in that moment, she made a decision and it worked, he ran. So you never know what you're capable of until you're in that situation. And as far as, you know, survivors of violent crime goes, you know, I was like, well, how do you cope? Well, you have to, you sort of have to go on. And so everybody kind of finds a way.
Right, and it's interesting too, with the Bundy case in particular, you know, there was a really excellent documentary about that not too long ago too.
Several, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the things that struck me, you know, that I was gonna ask you about from a crime writing perspective is you watch that series and you realize how profoundly different the world is in terms of, you know, Bundy would, his way of escaping would just be to cross state line, go across the country, and the network of communication between law enforcement, you know, was nothing like it is today, obviously, where that's very, very difficult now.
Yeah, it's a lot harder.
Yeah, yeah. What was it about Bundy in particular that interested you?
Well, he's the quintessential serial killer, right? He's this, you couldn't make him up, from the clean cut lawyer, you know, like one of the reasons he got away with it for so long is that everybody assumed they were looking for a monster, like some rabid, slovening animal that you would, you know, look at him and say, oh, that's the guy. You're not looking for the clean cut, like Republican guy who like is trying to help elect Nixon and has got all these lawyer friends and he's got a girlfriend and he's helping raise her daughter and he's so handsome and he's working for the suicide hotline. Like, he's the least likely guy. And then he escaped from police custody twice. You know, he fathered a daughter on death row. Like, there's so many things about this case that are larger than life and like hard to believe. And it's a very compelling story, but it's also people's lived experience. You know, and I've talked to people who've been touched in different ways, from a woman who was living in the fraternity or the sorority where Bundy attacked in Florida in one of his last big sprees. And she was home visiting family the weekend he broke in and attacked the girls there. So she came home and discovered her house was a crime scene, but like she could have been one of his victims, you know, like it's like the sliding doors thing. And another guy just happened to be living in Colorado when they were looking for Ted, and his name was Ted. And all of a sudden he was surrounded on the street being told to raise his hands. Like, I mean, there's so many people who are tangentially affected, but like for Carol DeRanche, I mean, he just dominated her life, basically. Imagine being 18 and having your story become about Ted Bundy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, really terrible. You know, but one thing I think we can all realize from the events of last week is that facial recognition, facial, you know, surveillance tools may change the game. And we're getting more civilians involved, you know, in using social media or these various techniques. I think it's a really scary thing to have civilians working cases like this in law enforcement. We had a program last year, Patrick, do you remember, with the gentleman who finished the McNamara book about the Golden State Killer, and he's really into, citizen participation and all, but that can be very dangerous. And I don't think that cops in general are all that welcoming, but now with the Capitol riots, we're seeing, in fact, that law enforcement is actually recruiting people to encouraging people to, but it's not like chasing a serial killer, you know, you're looking for a rioter on the Capitol steps is a somewhat different deal. But
yeah, whole phenomenon now of, what do they call them? Citizen detectives, I think. It's a mixed bag. I'm skeptical on one hand, but then again, for some of these cold cases, it's pretty amazing what somebody that, you know, doesn't have a full caseload of other things they're working on and can dig through and find things that the police have missed. So.
Well, and even the in-home DNA testing is finding people.
Yes.
They found one in Minnesota. He'd gotten away with murder for 25 years. He went to get his genealogy and did like 23andMe.
Right.
Cops were at the door and arrested him.
Yep.
They are finding that, you know, that is one, in fact, that's a fairly controversial, because they used that with the Golden State Killer. And now there's a big debate going on about privacy laws and other stuff. And you even see, you know, cops collecting DNA evidence by, you know, fishing something out of it, watching a suspect, and when they throw away a drink, you know, or something, you know, scurfing it up and testing the DNA. So the law is always behind in trying to, you know, monitor these things and adjudicate these things. So there are a lot of really tricky legal questions, I think, coming along.
Michael Connelly.
Surveillance cameras too, which is, you know, like another whole thing, particularly in Britain. What'd you say about
Michael? I was just going to say about Michael Connelly and his last, what's the guy's name? Jack McAvoy book. It dealt with these companies like 23andMe and other companies and how, I'm not sure if things have changed since he wrote the book, but he found out that those companies, there's very little oversight. And so there have been occasions of people actually finding victims by DNA profiling. It was a fascinating book. I think fair warning.
fair warning, right.
But anyway, I do have a question. This is an interesting one. Maureen again asks Joanna, was it true that Bundy was actually effective on the suicide hotline?
That is the rumor, yeah, that he was pretty good about talking people out of killing themselves, which is interesting that he would even be motivated to do that. And that's one of the interesting things about the whole story is like he killed people, but he may have also saved some lives. Like in balance, I don't think it comes out even, but
he was just trying to keep the victim pool completely full.
I guess, it's really interesting, right?
Well, that whole phenomenon of with him and, you know, of course, Ann Ramirez and Manson and all these other people are the women who, you know, fall in love with him and throw themselves at him.
Yeah,
that would be something, I don't know, for a writer to really explore in a novel, but maybe it's not the most appealing prospect, you know, getting into that. But it's a thing. It's a definite thing.
It is.
Kind of minor theme throughout my books is the cult of celebrity that follows Coben, who's the serial killer, even after he's been put away, and how that affects Ellery, the survivor.
I think that's one of the most important themes in your book, in fact, as we talked about way back at the beginning of this conversation about, you know, what happens when somebody becomes an unwanted or gains unwanted celebrity and then can't get away from it.
Yeah.
You know, it just dogs them. And that's harder and harder today to get away from it.
It is, yeah.
Very hard. So, and you know, all this doxing and other stuff can really ruin lives. You know, it's interesting. We did a symposium on the Franchise Affair over Christmas, Val McDermott and Dana Stabenow and Sujata Massey and I. And this, the Franchise Affair is basically about ruining a reputation. I mean, it's not a classical murder mystery, but the heart of it is gossip and you know, ruining a reputation. And you're seeing that today on such a broader scale, whether people can ever really escape that. Although we've lost shame. You know, shame used to be a thing that prevented people or made people kill, you know, cover-ups. And now, you know, instead it fuels a book deal or, you know, or a movie or makes you famous. So it's really, you know, crime. I've always thought that one of the great things about crime fiction is that it, and this is a quote, it cuts along the edge of social change. But I do think that crime writing really does, you know, look at society's trends and, you know, the fissures and the changes and all, and tries to track them and really keeps us alert to things that shift. I always learn things. Every crime novel I read, I learn something completely, often totally unexpected, you know? I mean, it's just like, wow, there's a book I looked at just now because I'm gonna post our January newsletter tomorrow, the second one. It's called How to Cook a Bear. And you'll like this, Joanna, because in fact, it's set in 1852 in Lapland in northern Sweden, and a young woman goes missing. And when she's found, they decide that it's a predatory bear. But of course, this is a crime novel, right? So we're pretty sure it's not really a predatory bear. It's a predatory human. And, but it turns out, interestingly enough, in paralleling what you do, that the detective in this case is a real live reformist pastor who ran into all kinds of trouble because his doctor, he was getting people sober and, you know, destroying the local alcohol economy and so forth. But I mean, he's a real person. But I mean, it's I thought it was fascinating, but I love the title, How to Cook a Bear.
Oh, it's a catcher.
Well, but you know, you do think it's a monster, right? You do think that this woman who's, you know, disemboweled in the snow or whatever, that it's going to be a monster like a bear.
Yeah.
And it's a different monster.
It is. Yeah.
It's a totally different monster. So there we are. Patrick, anything else? We've been on for about an hour. So
we have
lined us up here.
Well, Tracy, just wanted to ask you a little bit about Los Angeles, you know, and, you know, writing about this new city that is so, you know, it's such a, obviously an iconic place and very complicated, and so many people have written about it. And I read on the Jackie copy where it talks about how it's not, you know, the focus isn't on the gritty underbelly or the LA that we're used to seeing. And so I'm assuming you take us out into the suburbs or out into the places where people actually live, it says. I thought that was a great description.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, there's the movie industry and the music industry have a factor in this novel. And, you know, definitely the gritty underbelly plays a role in this as well. But I think that the core of what I focus on were the real, I mean, LA is crazy over the top, but it's a very small percentage of the people and the areas and the businesses in LA. There are lots of normal people who live in a normal LA. And yeah, listen, to me talking about normal, what do I know? But you know, it's just people are people. And so it was really, I just kind of want to show that. It's like, it's not just Hollywood. It's not, you know, all this debauchery and, you know, or horrible crime. It's a big city, like any other big city. And, you know, obviously, you know, it has its own regional personality and cultural differences. But yeah, it was just part of it because I always felt like, because I love Italy and I love living there. And I always felt like it kind of got a bad rep from everybody, everywhere. It's like, oh, LA. And everybody has a beef against LA, even if they've never been there. So I thought, wanted to, you know, give a little love in my representation and also some authenticity as well.
Joanna would have run into that with writing a book set in Las Vegas, you know, because we all have an idea of Las Vegas that, you know, is, and there are real people that live in Las Vegas who are gambling, don't work in casinos, probably, you know, maybe a telephone repairman or a plumber or whatever. So there we go. It's also here in Scottsdale. So we are. Ladies, it's really been a pleasure to see you both. I'm delighted to have met you, Joanna, for the first time, and I'm so pleased to see Tracy again. I was telling Tracy, Patrick, that we have that wonderful picture of her and her mom.
Yeah.
Still up in the store. So
I'll be back to see it, I promise.
Well, let's hope we can do this in person. So let me remind everybody again, we do have autographed copies for sale of both books. And I will encourage you to read the Monkey Wrench series if you haven't. I certainly recommend that you go back and read Joanna's first three books since I have ordered all three. So I'm going to be right there because I'm really fascinated with how it got there. So good night, everybody.
Good night. Thank you, Barbara. Thank you, Patrick. Great seeing you.
It's been a pleasure. And let us thank everybody who's watched us tonight or who will watch us or who will listen to the podcast that we'll post tomorrow. Great. Good night.
Good night, everyone.
Kings River Life magazine now has a mystery podcast called Mystery Rat's Maze. Episodes consist of short stories and first chapters of mystery novels read by local actors. To listen to the episodes and subscribe to the podcast, go to mysteryratsmaze.podbean.com or find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more.